my old wildlife professor used to say, forestry is not rocket science, it's 10 times more complicated. The misconception, once you go and burn it, that's it, the forest is gone. Well, it simply isn't true. There's a whole set of natural processes. It's evolved over millennia that eucalypt forest burns from time to time, and it burns incredibly hot. Animals know how to move away from smoke, and then they know how to recolonize back. Plants have seeds that get ground stored and then released during a fire. And so the biodiversity comes back. And that probably is the biggest misconception. Once you've done it, then you can't have it back. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Hello, I'm Claire Bennett, host of the Original Thinkers podcast, where we take a deeper dive into what it takes to have an original thought, the impact of it, and how it endures over time. At a time when original thinking could not be more important, I'll be talking to some of our country's leading minds. In this series, we're exploring the full timber supply chain, from the timber growers to processors, architects, problem solvers, makers, builders, and finally the residents who get to enjoy these beautiful spaces. On today's episode, I speak with Dave White, Forest Manager for Sustainable Timber Tasmania. Welcome, Dave.
Yeah, good morning.
You've been working in forests for over 20 years. What led you to a career in forestry?
Bit of accident, really. I was fussing around for a university to apply for, and University of British Columbia had a forestry program, and I thought, well, I like trees. So I applied for a forestry degree and got accepted at UBC.
Forestry is a big industry in British Columbia, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
What can you tell me about the industry over there?
Oh, massive. I think 95% of it's Crown land, and there's several really large companies, and there's a whole bunch of trees out there. And so it's a resource that gets used, and gets used with a bit of pride, I might add. I ended up on Vancouver Island and working up and down in coastal temperate rainforests on the mid-coast, as well as west coast of Vancouver Island, and did that for about 10 years, both doing a bit of wildlife research, but also mainly engineering and silviculture. So, for want of better words, industrial forest operations. That was quite an interesting time.
Is it native forestry in British Columbia?
100%. Because in a lot of parts of Canada, it snows, the trees actually don't grow for a certain amount of time of the year. So really, the best you can do on a really good growing site is kind of a 40-year rotation, and that's sort of in the southern, South Vancouver Island, South BC. After that, really, you're looking at sort of a 60 to 80-year rotation to get something big enough. So to manage intensively, like you do plantations sort of in warmer parts of the world, there's just no return on it. So it's 100% native. Some of the listeners might get a bit confused because the main regeneration technique is actually planting seedlings, but they're planted usually a mixture of species, and it's sort of free planted. They're never planted in rows. They're just sort of planted to the microsite. So even though they're planted, it's managed on a native forest regime.
And so this is interesting. You did your training in British Columbia, and then at some point, which we're going to get to, you came to Tasmania, and the way you would manage a forest there and the way you manage a forest here would be quite different, wouldn't it?
No, I mean, in a lot of ways, there's a lot of principles that are still the same. And so having trained formally and then gone and done various operations on the coast, it was actually a pretty good background to coming here. Now, when I came here, I got off the plane and I couldn't tell you a single species, but what I could do is recognize patterns. And, you know, the codes that we operated under, the forest practices code here was very similar in terms of addressing things like everybody has streamside reserves in the world, as far as I know. Everybody has a rate of cut. Everybody has a size of a coop that you're supposed to limit yourself to. Everybody doesn't want to cause landslides. And so there's various different rules around how you do it. The nuances down here are different, but the principles are still very much the same.
So when you study a degree in forestry, what are the types of things that you're learning?
Oh, gee, well, you start off with sort of your basic maths and chemistries, and they make you do an English course just to make sure you can write and that sort of thing. But then you get into silviculture, dendrology, which is the study of trees and tree anatomy. Silviculture can be quite intensive in terms of how you manage over the length of the rotation and how you manage over a landscape as well. Things like studying forest pests, fire management, conservation issues. Gee, it was a long time ago. Oh, hydrology. You sort of come out as a bit of a generalist scientist, knowing a little bit about everything. And then you go out in the real world and start applying that stuff. So sometimes you don't have to be an expert in it, but you need to know it exists. Mm. And in certain instances, you just need to be clued up enough that it's time to get a specialist in for some of those subjects. So for instance, I know we need to do flow calculations to minimize the risk of a bridge installation blowing out. Could I do a flow calculation now? No, but I know you hire an engineer and you get him to do it.
Yeah.
And then that safeguards you because you know every now and then you have a 1 in 20 or 1 in 50 year storm, and that's got the capacity to wash out a forest structure. So there's a component of engineering associated with it as well. So it's a fairly broad bit of study, but it's all meant to be applied in a managed forest setting.
So tell me about your role now at Sustainable Timber Tasmania. What's your role within the company? What does that entail?
My current role is I'm the Forest Operations Manager for the Southern Region. And through that, we're basically, we call ourselves the region. So we're the people on the ground making things happen. I have 6 coordinators reporting to me. I have a coordinator for planning, which is the people that look at long-term wood supply. And then sort of, I have a coordinator for forest practices plans, who's the practical sort of developer of the FPPs, which is the legal document you need before you grow and harvest trees or establish trees. I've got a coordinator for production who's in charge of logging contractors or the harvesting contractors. I've got a coordinator for roads who's basically deals with all the structures and all the forest roads that people like to enjoy. And then I've got a coordinator for silviculture, I call them, but forest establishment. So both native and plantation establishment.
So there's an enormous amount involved in managing healthy, sustainable forests.
Yep.
And I think sometimes that is simplified enormously in, particularly in the media, about what goes on out there.
Very much so. I think, to be honest, I think we're underserved by the media in this state. There's a lack of critical journalism, particularly on the subject of forestry, but it makes me think it's probably the same for other serious subjects like healthcare and education.
Well, it does. When you are very educated on a particular topic and an industry and you know what's happening out there and then you know what ends up in the public discourse, public domain, and you see that there's this massive difference, it does make you start to think about anything else you're reading, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And so I question whether if I'm fully informed on something like healthcare. So yeah, no, it's a bit of a worry, really.
So as then a forester, and so this is a great opportunity for you as someone who's incredibly knowledgeable, who's worked in this industry in arguably the most highly regarded forest practices systems in the world. How involved is forest management in Tasmania in our public forests?
Right. So on PTPZL, which is Permanent Timber Production Zone land, which formerly was known as State Forest, which was a lot easier to say.
What's a lot easier to
but
say?
But how involved? Well, I guess it goes back to the mandate of what Sustainable Timber Tasmania is, and that's to make available 137,000 cubic meters of saw log per year. Make available, not necessarily deliver it, which is a sticking point at every annual report, but make available. How involved is forestry? Highly. And I know you interviewed the chief forest practices officer a while ago, and I thought she spoke really well about it, but I can only iterate some of her comments in that just to get an operation off the ground, first of all, you have to have a view of the long-term wood supply. So there's a whole team of people dedicated to wood modeling. And that's over the long term. That's over 90, 100 years. So that's how far ahead we're thinking. From that, some of my planners will come up with sort of 10-year scenarios for harvesting and then ultimately develop something called a 3-year plan, which is basically a statement of intent with where we harvest. Sometimes we have very good information on the coupes before we select them. Some of them further out, we don't. And so we have to go and look at them on the ground. Some coupes can be incredibly tricky to plan. To be honest, some coops, you can spend days out in the field and then realize it's just not even viable for whatever reason, whether if it's an ecological reason or a physical reason, like an engineering impasse, or possibly a financial reason as well. What people don't see is the ones that slip through the cracks and just aren't necessarily there to be developed. So there's an incredible amount of work before a single tree is cut or before a single piece of tape is hung, to be honest. And there's some very complex problems out there. Threatened species is probably one of the biggest ones on our minds these days. So then you've got a whole issue about trying to develop road to get into a coop or make sure there's access. Mm. Some of our network was put in a long, long time ago in the 60s. So we've got wooden culverts and bridges that we have to, before you even start thinking about building new road, you actually have to replace the old structures as well. So every 3 years or so, we inspect these bridges and we sort of have a rolling inspection. So that in itself is a bit of a project in itself. And then bridges aren't cheap. So a 10-meter span could run you up to $250,000. Wow. So it's big decisions when you try and make these. They're not light. Then following roading, you've got all the aspects of harvesting. And so obviously a big one is contractor safety. So making sure that the coop is well engineered and well planned in terms of where a landing goes so that they've got the best chance to recover the most wood, but also not compromise, not put them in a precarious situation. And that involves managing things like steep ground, hazardous trees, which can be at odds or in conflict with wildlife management aspirations. So there's always a bit of a compromise in forestry. You never quite have everything perfect. And
you're in a natural environment. It's right. Not like a factory where you've got certain inputs that go in and you're in control of all of those things. And it's, a production line, it's nature.
Yeah, that's right. So you've got all the aspects of harvesting that go with it. And then behind that, there's a whole series of logistics in terms of making sure the customers don't run out of wood, but they're not overwhelmed with wood. And then throw in things like snowstorms or fire weather shutdown or holidays or something like COVID or labor shortages, which I think there's a lot of industries that are dealing with that right now. And then following harvesting, you've got a regeneration component because we don't deforest in a managed forest. And make that really clear. We do not deforest. We have a managed forest where trees are put back where trees were growing in the first place. And that's the sustainability or the renewability about it. But that in itself can be fairly complex. I laugh because this time of the year, we're preparing our annual budget and they want to know how much I'm going to spend on regeneration. And my ability to regenerate, particularly on some of the clear fells or ARNs, involves the use of fire. And so I have to predict the weather a year from now. When and whether it's going to be a reasonable burning season or not. So I always find that amusing. That's part of the budget process.
Like, how do you do that? And so this is a really interesting point, is that your job is to get the best regeneration of that forest area possible because it's about sustainability and making sure that that forest comes back as close to, if not the same, as the forest that was there beforehand. Generally, it's healthier. But you have to use the tools and the processes that forest has adapted to love for regeneration, and often they're the contentious ones. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I guess the biggest, most contentious one is the regeneration burning. That's got a whole host of baggage with it. It's not something we just made up. It's not something because we're pyromaniacs that we do. It's based on a bunch of science that was done out at Medina in the 1960s, Gilbert Cunningham, I think 60s or 50s, I have to look that up. But it's a tried and true method. And the idea actually isn't to burn per se. The idea is to create an ash bed. Mm. It's not a carbon copy of a natural process. But if you imagine a wildfire event, particularly like a landscape level wildfire event, what happens is the fire races through, it really cooks things. It creates a significant ash bed, but for a natural regen to occur, there should be an amount of seed on the trees that are getting burnt. And you can actually feel it during some wildfires. If you're there, you can actually feel the seed raining down on your hard hat.
Wow.
I think it's the smoke that actually somehow gets
releases
the capsule.
The seed.
It gets the capsules just sort of open. And if you catch it at just the right moment, you can feel the seed sort of shifting down. In a perfect world, the seed goes into the ash bed, rain comes a little bit later, encapsulates the seed in an ash coating, if you like, of nutrients. And then as the moisture goes up going into winter and in the spring, they sprout and grow. So on that, in terms of replacing like for like, so STT does have a set of quality standards and for managing native forest. And that includes harvesting seed off the coops. Preferably it's off the coop itself in the same proportions as the species that existed there prior. And so this is part of the planning exercise, is actually identifying the communities and the ratios of the different species. And it can be very simple or very complicated. I've written plans that had 7 different species on it that we needed to collect seed for. And the regeneration guys looked a bit sweaty because they thought that was a tall order. But it can go either way. Generally, we try and get it off the coop, but we do sort of have the state carved up into what we call seed zones. And that's because what they've shown over time is that, say, an obliqua seed collected from the northeast maybe doesn't perform as well as if you planted it down near the catamaran, down near Southport, and vice versa. So they do seem to be somewhat, they seem to have a bit of a territory where
they've adapted.
Yeah, where they've sort of just somehow adapted to that slight microclimate. And so the closer you can get it to the coop, the better. So the next step out is we have these seed zones. There's 12 or 13 of them now, mm-hmm. just to give you an idea. But the idea is to just get it as close to home as possible. And it's all naturally collected. We do that through a number of ways. We recover the capsules off the coop while when the trees are being felled. But equally, if there's a really good crop on some more mature trees, we'll send a climber up to prune off the seed capsules, give it a bit of a haircut, and we can recover. That in itself is not a cheap exercise either, getting a fully insured arborist to go up a tree. But it does represent or constitute the lengths that we'll go to make sure that ecologically we're maintaining that on-site genetics, but also the ecological integrity of the place.
And then I've been down and seen what happens post-seed collection, and even that process is quite fascinating and very strict.
Yes.
Yeah, so you've got the batch number for every batch
Absolutely.
Of seeds that's matched to the site, and the batch numbers are maintained with almost a chain of custody, aren't they, through the seed drying process.
Yep.
So the seed that's come from that coop is dried and prepared, ready to go back to that exact same coop.
Yep.
And all managed, as I say, with a chain of custody so it can't go astray, and then stored in basically like a library.
Yep, a cool room library, that's right. Yep.
Yeah, until it's time.
Yep.
Then you take it back out to the forest once you've got that ash bed, and are you seeding from helicopter?
Generally, we do seed from helicopter, and there's a little hopper that controls the rate of spread. So seed isn't cheap. So there's always, again...
Well, if you've got to send arborists up one tree at a time.
That's right. So seed isn't cheap. So we've got to have a compromise between, you know, it'd be great if we could whack on just a nice thick creamy layer of seed, but that's not the case. We've got to sprinkle it and be a bit wise with it. We look at the site prior to and decide how risky it is about regen and whether we want to put a bit more on or a bit less on. And there's a whole bunch of factors that contribute to that. So, but there isn't basically every coop gets evaluated for how much seed we want to put on it. And what we're looking for, different batches of seed germinate at different rates. And so you may put a greater volume of a certain kind of seed on to get the same germinance you would with lesser volume. So there's a whole bunch of math that goes into that as well. There's nothing simple about forestry.
No. That's why I say the simplified messages that you read about are infuriating because I know how much goes on out there to make sure we have beautiful natural forests.
Well, and the other one that's worth noting is STT has just started in the last couple of years what we're calling the strategic seed bank. And what that is, our seed guys really like it because it's a license to collect more seed. But what it is we're going to have two sort of separate accounts. So we'll have the operational account for regenerating our native harvest. But in addition to that, we're going to have, it's almost like an emergency seed bank. So when Amazing. We have these landscape level fires, like we did just this past month, we'll do an assessment, and there's a whole bunch of neat tools that you can do that, including burn intensity maps collected by satellites, but also sometimes you just put a person up in the helicopter to go look at it. And we'll make a call about whether we need to sprinkle some seed on that. And so we have that backup plan for when we have things like the Rivo Gel River fires, those real nasty landscape level fires that we had in 2019. We drained our seed banks basically and trying to get stuff back onto yeah. severely impacted forest in an effort to at least get something going. Because otherwise you might have sort of a devalued or degenerated kind of residual forest.
What's amazing listening to you speak is you hear so much about how, you know, our forests are in danger and, you know, forestry's attacking our forests. And all I ever hear foresters talk about is how to get more trees and more healthy forests. Your whole job is spent, sure, there's an element where you're producing timber, but so much more of your job is about making sure we have incredible healthy forests covering as much land as we possibly can.
Yep. No, absolutely. And also, it's not to say we're unaware of who uses the forest too. So it's about managing water quality. It's about, you know, the reason there's so many known eagle nests on PTPZL, for example, is because I spend north of $200,000 a year on helicopters searching for eagle nests and also following up to see whether they're active or not. We have an incredible data set on PTPZL about what eagles are up to, for example. And we're interested in managing those too. Might not always come out in the media, that's the case.
And you said you went back and had a listen to Anne Schutter and her interview on here, talking about what goes into the planning and management of forests under our forest practices system. Timber management is like one tiny fraction of it, really, because it's streamside reserves and it's managing for big trees and it's managing for cultural values, and any value that we think is worth holding on to is put into a zone that can't be touched. And so often when you do a coop, there's sometimes you might only actually harvest half of it and the rest of it's put into a reserve even within the production zone.
Yep. No, I mean, look, you're doing well if you get half a coop in some parts of our land these days. A quarter or an eighth is sometimes what we end up with just
wow,
in trying
to... That in itself is amazing. So that's new to me, but to think that within our production zone, the perception often is it's just this clear fell and burn and you go and you just take it all out. And it's like, could not be further from the truth. So an eighth of a particular area, coop, is what you actually might harvest. And the rest of it has
Sometimes,
been deemed
yeah.
to have high conservation value or threatened species within or a stream that needs protecting or
usually all
eagle's
the above.
Nest. Yeah.
Yeah. And look, it's the space we're in. I think the other point to make is sort of, we adaptively manage. And so what we did 10 years ago isn't what we're doing now. And we respond to science. Certainly, you know, a classic right now is the swift parrot. And we're experimenting pretty heavily right now. And mast owls on the horizon as well, I should add. We're experimenting pretty heavily right now with retaining as much habitat as we can. Habitat trees even within the coop. And that's where maybe there's not as much product in them, but they have value because they have some of the more mature elements that are valuable to some of these species. And by that, I mean hollows and or potentially food source. And that's a body of work that's ongoing. The tension there is, of course, worker safety. You're asking somebody to work around a tree that might be unstable or have dead large limbs or a big lean and that sort of thing. And so you've always got to be looking for ways to trying to get an outcome, but not compromise on certain things. It's constantly evolving situation as well. I expect what we did last year, 5 years from now, we might be doing something completely different as well.
And I think that the key thing you said there is we respond to science. And going back to you talking about what your degree was about when you trained to be a forester, it's a science degree.
Yes.
You know, it is a really technical field. Whilst you said to begin with, you have to be a generalist in many, many areas, you do. You're covering so many different things when you're managing a forest. It's not just about managing for timber. It's, as you say, managing for eagle's nests and threatened species and all of those things. So it's a highly technical field that you're in. How do you think our forest practices system, or the way we're doing forestry, relates to places like British Columbia, which is British Columbia sort of considered to be up there as the best in the world, you know, best practice?
I think every first world country thinks their forest practices are the best in the world. Look, it's British Columbia is equally robust in my mind.
Equally as robust as Tasmania?
Yeah, I think so. Look, Tasmania, it's got a reasonable system. It's got a pretty solid code. I like the impartiality of the Forest Practices Authority. So an example in British Columbia is if you needed a specialist, in British Columbia, you have private companies that have timber rights to the land in various forms, like tree farm licenses and forest licenses and that kind of thing. If they need to do an assessment, they will get a biologist or a geotechnical specialist or something, but they're basically paying them to do the specialists. And you might say there's a chance for a conflict of interest there who's getting paid. Whereas here, probably one of the good things is that there's an impartiality from the regulator. And so you're right, forestry is highly technical, and over time you gradually build up a body of knowledge. But probably the biggest one is knowing when to call a specialist and get specialist advice. And what the Forest Practices Authority offers is an arm's length view of how to implement something or go about managing a particular value, whether if it's cultural, ecological, scenic. That's probably a win for Tasmania, I think. I think things like water quality are, you know, if there's a system for managing it, I've got no trouble drinking out of the streams and rivers in Tasmanian production forest. Very often do it because I don't like carrying a lot of heavy water when I'm out in the field. I'll just fill up from the nearest stream. And I think, you know, there's simple things like a rate of cut. People aren't going hell for leather, just harvesting. There's a discipline around it. Consider it fairly robust down here.
Are you familiar with other forest practices systems in the world? But would you say on a, you know, international scale, we are best practice?
Look, I mean, I think you only have to look at the results of our regeneration. And I think Tasmania as a whole, if you really step back and look at the landscape and you look at all the parks and reserves, and that's great, there's only a small amount, a relatively small amount of land devoted to timber production. And it's managed over a period of time. So, yeah, I'm hedging my bets, but I am only familiar with Canadian forestry, to be honest. I haven't really done a lot anywhere else. But it's on par with Canada and probably has some outperforms it in some spots. But again, you're dealing with different ecology, different trees and that sort of thing. But yeah, it's up there with Canada. No problem saying that.
And as you quite rightly said then, it's a small industry. I mean, how would we compare size-wise to, say, Canada in terms of, well, quite boutique, aren't we?
Teeny tiny.
Teeny tiny. Yeah, and I think sometimes there's a perception that we've got this massive forestry machine, and it's like, no, it is a tiny boutique little industry.
But that said, I think it's worth noting that what I can say is the timber down here is absolutely world-class, like just absolutely special. And, you know, as you know, Claire, I'm pretty big fan of special species as well. Yeah. But even just the Taz oak is just for strength, beauty, color, durability. You know, my whole house is Taz oak hardwood floors, and I won't have a carpet on it because
I'm the same.
I love looking at it. Yeah, it's strong, good to work with. I do a bit of woodworking. So, yeah, that's one thing that you can call it boutique, but it's boutique with a real high quality timber.
And that is absolutely recognised by architects and makers and designers who do love Tasmanian timbers. And I guess when they're tasked with making sustainable choices and they're hearing all that noise, you know, it can be sometimes, I guess, hard for them to navigate whether or not it is appropriate to use Tasmanian timbers. But what would you say to that regarding sustainability?
Well, I think one of the things that they could be assured of is we get audited like crazy to a whole bunch of standards. So the Forest Practices Authority regularly audits us. We have our own internal quality standards, as I alluded to, that ensure that we put back, we regenerate when we harvest. We also have a certification system that we get externally audited on every 9 months or something like that, part of SDT will get audited by our certification body. In addition to that, we have a whole bunch of safety audits that get conducted as well. So it's not just about the ecological forest and growing and that kind of thing. It's also about that the workers are treated fairly. So there's a whole social responsibility as well in terms of managing a forest. I remember in university seeing pictures of a whole bunch of guys in bare feet in Papua New Guinea rolling logs onto a train kind of thing. Well, you know, that just isn't on down here. So there's a whole other component about the social responsibility. Well, look, my message would be, if you've got any doubts, come down and see me and I'll show you.
I just think, wouldn't it be brilliant? We did, and it was pre-COVID, and I guess that was probably what ended that, but had a visiting architects program, which you were obviously a part of. And I think there's just nothing better than taking people out and letting them see what you do and the brilliance of what you do, because you know the second they see it, they go, wow, God, your regenerated forests are beautiful. They're incredible. They're healthy, and that you can't tell the difference.
Well, and biodiverse, I might add.
And biodiverse and full of wildlife.
Full of ecological services being offered throughout the rotation.
So Marie Yee, who works at STT, I spoke with her once and she said she's got this incredible story.
Yep.
And she said she used to placard under the Sydney Harbour Bridge against forestry in Tasmania. Like she was a full-on activist. And she was like, right, biodiversity scientist, I'm going to go and do all this research and prove that, you know, they're not doing the right thing down there or they could be doing it better. And so she'd done all this study in native reserve forest and then came to Tasmania and went into the regen forest and went, hang on a minute, there's more biodiversity here than in all of the reserved areas. What's going on? So she's like, I'm sure they could be doing it better. Went and did all this study to try and prove that they could do it better and went, you know what? You can't. Like STT were doing it better than she could possibly work out. And in the end, she came and took a job with you. She's like, these are the experts in biodiversity. I'm going to go and work
with them. To be honest, she's heading up our swift parrot monitoring program and taking the science behind how you do that to the next level. So we're starting to get into things like acoustic recorders to do the detections when people aren't around. And so it's brilliant. And then she informs us as to where we think we can operate or, you know, if we need to adjust our plans, that kind of thing. So, yeah, we work very closely with Marie on threatened species.
And it's just such a brilliant story to come from placarding against it and then going, you know what, I'm going to get in there and do something about it, and then realising that actually we're doing it better than anyone she'd come across. And she's like, I'm going to go and work with them because they're the best at this. And I guess as well, she thought, I can make the biggest difference there.
Which she's actively doing every day, absolutely.
Yeah, it's amazing. What do you think are the main misconceptions then about Tasmanian forests and forestry?
Well, my old wildlife professor used to say, forestry is not rocket science. It's 10 times more complicated.
I love that.
I think one of the biggest things that's really hard to navigate is the sight of a harvested forest is confronting.
Yeah.
And I'm a forester and I like going out in tall, big, older forest, and I enjoy it because it's beautiful. The wood fascinates me and the way the trees grow, and it's absolutely fascinating. Is a harvested forest as nice to look at in a harvested and burnt forest? No. Mm-mm. It's not. That's a soundbite, that's a picture that's incredibly difficult to overcome. What foresters do, though, is they don't look at that particular moment in time and think, that's it, it's all over. We're thinking 10 years ahead, we're thinking 50 years ahead, we're thinking 100 years ahead and knowing what's going to be. And I'll get back to my regeneration group, which is constantly thinking about the opportunities they're going to create for the next generation of foresters to come. That's how they're thinking in their minds. So the misconception that once you go and whack over a forest and burn it, that's it, the forest is gone. Well, it simply isn't true. There's a whole set of natural processes, and it's evolved over millennia that eucalypt forest burns from time to time, and it burns incredibly hot from time to time, and long before anybody was doing forestry. So animals know how to move away from smoke, and then they know how to recolonize back into an area when the opportunity arises. Plants have seeds that get ground stored and then released during a fire event. And so the biodiversity comes back in all the plant forms. Things like musk, for example, has this big lignotuber at the bottom of it. So it might cook off the top, but then it'll sprout back up and there's plenty of musk and regrowth forest. So there's plenty of diversity there. And that probably is the biggest misconception, that once you've done it, then you can't have it back. I've alluded to it throughout the conversation that, you know, we're not interested in wildlife. Nothing could be further from the truth. We're poignantly aware that we've got to try and look after habitat, particularly for species that may be compromised in terms of population size. That said, forestry is always about compromise. It's never quite perfect, because at the end of the day, I question whether people are prepared to admit that they have an impact. We humans have a footprint, and forestry is an expression of that. So it's not just about going down to Bunnings and picking up a bit of timber because you want to build a deck or do something like that. At some point, anytime you've used wood on a hobby or a reno or something like that, a forest got cut down for that. But people don't seem to make that link. They're happy enough to use wood. I think that's great. I think it's a very responsible building material, and I think the possibilities for using it more are coming online with all sorts of mouse lamb and that sort of thing. But I don't think people make the link. If you buy something made out of steel, there's a mine somewhere. As soon as you buy a computer, there's all sorts of mining that's gone on. And that might not look nice either. If you buy a bit of timber, there's a forest that got cut down.
And the difference between the forestry and the mine is that no one's filling in the hole with what they took out again. It's extractive.
Yeah.
Whereas forestry is regenerative.
Well, and that's what we find when we've got people concerned about us cutting down what essentially is second growth forest. You know, we look at some of the 80-year-old forest that's sort of on rotation now and ready to go. And it looks so good, we get an element of stakeholder feedback that isn't happy for us to cut it down because they can see all the values.
But we regenerated that.
But it came from previous harvesting. So, you know, the truth is right now we're working on a series of coupes. So we're about to reestablish the third rotation from a managed forest, from the forest industry.
Sustainability in action speaks for itself.
You know, the secret is it does grow back.
One question that comes up time and time again is the question of old growth.
Yep.
And it's sort of the elephant in the room where it's a difficult question to answer, and people are like, well, yes or no. Do you touch it or don't you touch it? But then also that in itself is a phrase that's bandied about. Like, what constitutes old growth? What is an old tree? What's not? And what do people think it is versus what it actually is?
Well, this, you know, in as much as a clear fell can be one stump, old growth can be a lot of things to all people. There is a whole body of scientific literature debating what old growth is. At the end of the day, to the layperson, in most people's minds, it's a big tree. And regardless of how it got to be a big tree or why it's a big tree or what is it, one big tree surrounded by acres and acres of little ones, that doesn't seem to matter. So the answer is, do we cut down big trees? The answer is yes. The way I can best explain it is I'll simplify it down and say we wanted to manage to an 80-year rotation and we had 80 hectares. And we harvest 1 hectare a year and regenerate it, and we just work our way through. Where the Tasmanian forest estate is at on PTPZL is, call it, we're at year 70, and we've still got 10 more years of sort of harvesting mature stems. At that point, the cycle will kick in and we'll be purely managing regrowth. The reason we still have mature stems is because we didn't go nuts at the beginning. There was a discipline about having a sustained yield. And this is what I talked about at the beginning of the podcast, is we have people dedicated to making sure there's a long-term, we're looking at 100 years, there's a long-term yield to come off the forests. And so because the Forestry Commission, then Forestry Tasmania, then Sustainable Timber Tasmania exercised that discipline about not raising the entire place to the ground in one quick fell swoop, because you don't want to do that, because that mucks up a sustainable wood flow, is as a result of that discipline, then there is still an amount of mature stems on the landscape as zoned for production timber. That's as best as I can explain.
I think that's a brilliant explanation. And then by the time you get back to the start, then they're going to be old trees again. But that's the point, is that you want to be allowing forests to do a full cycle.
But the other point I'd make is, and go back to my simplified scenario about 80 hectares, is we have another 80 hectares sitting there that we'll never touch. And so it's not that I'm saying managing PTPZL, we're going to eradicate all the old growth. Nothing could be further from the truth. We've got all sorts of reserves that manage for big trees, big large trees, and allow for ecological processes for even younger trees to develop into older, more mature trees with all the accoutrements like hollows and thermal cover and whatnot. So there's a huge reserve component sort of dotted and slicing across the landscape within production forest. I'm only talking about the ground that we think we can reasonably harvest is where some of those bigger trees come from.
No, good explanation. And I think it just makes perfect sense, the way that you explain it. So what do you think then the future of native forestry looks like in Tasmania, or what would you hope it to be?
Oh, probably possibly two different things.
two big questions.
Well, as we've seen in WA and unfortunately Victoria, you're always one election away from some kind of a decision. What I would hope is that through exercises like what you're conducting, Claire, is that somehow people can start to see the value in a native, in a managed native forest estate, the forest roads and the opportunities they provide in terms of accessing really neat areas. And so the options the forest road network gives you in the event of a landscape level wildfire, the suppression opportunities are far better than if you've just got nothing but bush. I would like to see native forestry continue. I'd like to see Australia be self-sufficient for timber.
Me too.
And I think, you know, a stat like a $2 billion trade deficit on timber, you know, how is that globally responsible when you've got a resource here that you can manage sustainably? That just defies logic.
It does defy logic, and it's massive. And you think about that, and we're importing, you know, enormous amounts from other countries all over the world. And one of the key things that makes timber such a great material to use is that it has this natural ability, this perfect technology for sucking in carbon out of the atmosphere and storing it. And then if we can then use that in our built environment, we're creating a long-term carbon store. When the whole world's grappling with how do we not only reduce emissions of carbon, but how do we capture and lock some back up because we've gone too far, we're all looking for technology to do that. But it exists. And when you go and bring that timber from the other side of the world, you're negating a lot of those benefits because of the travel miles.
The carbon budget. Another thing I'd add is that because native forestry grows trees slower, you actually get different strength properties out of it. I recently toured a truss plant up in Albany, and they're building these trusses to order for all sorts of houses and that kind of thing, primarily radiata pine. But they had a few bundles of spruce from Germany. Beautiful looking wood, but people would call it old growth. It's probably managed for 80 or 90 year rotations would be my guess. Beautiful looking wood. But where they had certain trusses of certain dimensions, they needed to use that older, tighter growth ring wood to get the strength that the engineer would sign off on, because radiata pine simply couldn't cut it. And so you've got to recognize there's value in this slower, older growing stuff. It has different properties, and it shouldn't be discounted just because the sight of a burnt stump is confronting.
You also manage a lot of plantation.
Yes.
On Sustainable Timber Tasmania's land. And so there has been for some time this argument that we can do without native forestry because we've got plantations. And so my answer to that would firstly be, well, a plantation's not a plantation's not a plantation. It depends what you planted. It depends how you manage it. So we have a lot of plantation in Tasmania that has been grown for pulpwood, but that's a very different product. Making paper versus making hardwood are two very different things. How much plantation do we have in Tasmania that's been managed for sawlog?
Ooh.
My understanding is it's not a lot.
It's not a lot. We had about 25,000, 26,000 hectares on PTPZL. And that was primarily pruned with the idea of making some thinned and pruned to make some sort of solid wood product, whether if it's a saw log or some sort of peeled product, or, I mean, it might get sawn up, but incorporated in things like cusp are doing sort of this mass lamb kind of stuff, which is going to be the way of the future, I believe. Yes, I think there's people interested in seeing whether plantation grown for pulp could actually be manufactured using different techniques. I guess the other thing is if we all decide that we want to manage plantation for the solid timber product stream, you're right, the regimes are potentially different and what you planted are potentially different. So the truth is you probably got to wait 25 years before the first log comes off the assembly line.
Yeah.
And so what are you going to do in between?
But also, in your experience as a forester, are they like for like? Are we comparing apples and apples?
Look, I don't think so, personally. They all have uses, and I think that's important. I don't think it's a case of either or. I think it's all great, and it all has its spot. Let's be honest, the domestic building industry is on radiata pine. That's pretty much how it's done now. Carpenters rarely have the tools to, like, an electrician has to go out and buy a special drill bit if he confronts a house built out of Tazza Oak 2x4s, because it's just not as easy to drill the holes.
Yeah. Solid structure.
So it's all got its place.
And when we've got a $2 billion trade deficit in timber, I don't understand why the question is always about what can we replace what with. It's like, we need more.
That's it. And I think I read somewhere it's even more for solid wood. So the trade deficit is based on the fact that we're actually pumping out a whole bunch of pulp as export. But the solid wood imports are actually even higher.
Yeah, so if you don't offset with the pulp wood exports,
it would actually be even higher.
Yeah.
You know, there's a great opportunity, I think, to use both techniques. And they both have their places, and it's all part of managing a forest.
And so realistically, to sort of finish up this discussion in a way that closes it off, I guess, for architects and people listening who are thinking, okay, is it plantation? Is it native? What should I be using? What's the right thing to do? My thoughts are, as long as it's certified sustainable under one of the two major international schemes, you really can't go too far wrong.
Yeah, and typically under some certification schemes, places like Canada and Australia, the bar is actually higher than if you go to some of these other countries. So it's the same certification scheme, but the local standards are sort of not as great. So that's worth knowing.
I think that's critical to know, because going back to that $2 billion trade deficit, you know, you might say, oh, well, I've got a preference for FSC, so I'm going to buy something from another country with FSC. That doesn't mean it's even met the standard we would expect here in Tasmania, does it?
Well, I'll give you an example. I was involved a bit with FSC in British Columbia, and what they did is they did local standards. So they did one for each province. And the standard for British Columbia, after the three chambers got together, was something like, oh, I forget, it was like 275 pages. And then the next biggest standard in Canada was somewhere around the 75 page. Hmm. So you go, hold on. How is this an equal playing field?
Well, and then you extrapolate that and look at it on a global scale.
That's right.
They've done a good job of marketing themselves in...
Of course they have.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But look, it is certified. And I think it's what you want to specify for. So if you're specifying for strength, maybe you need a certain something. If you just want to put up stud walls that are covered in plaster, and, well, you specify radiata pine, don't you? Because that's the most cost effective and that's what people care about. If you want to have sort of a unique feature like a vanity, I'd encourage you to consider specialty timbers and do something really nice and with a nice piece of hardwood that'll last for forever. So there's all sorts of different options there.
And so for architects, anyone who was on the fence about whether or not they can, I guess, from an ethical and environmental standpoint, continue to specify Tasmanian timber without concern. As the man in charge of managing our forests here, can you give them that confidence?
Well, I have kids. I wouldn't do this if I thought it was unethical. I believe in it. I've seen it happen, like on the ground. I live it every day, and I watch the cycle. You know, my wiring might be different, because I'm looking sort of 80, 100 years, but also managing in the current now. And we're very much aware of the special values and the uniqueness of Tasmania. And we're not going about, in our minds, threatening that. But we are trying to produce a clean, green, usable product that also has an element of beauty to it. And architects know that putting wood in a building just gives it that lift and all the, you know, the mental health benefits and all the rest of it. So from the perspective of a forest manager, I believe in what's happening down here, and I'd like to see it continue into perpetuity because I believe it can be.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Dave. It's been brilliant to have you in. You've covered some of the topics that I know are on people's minds, and they want to hear from a forester. They want to hear from someone who's on the ground to give them that confidence to continue to specify Tasmanian timbers and other certified timbers that are certified sustainable. So it's been really informative, brilliant for me. Is there anything else you would like to add before we finish up?
Oh, I should have thought of a clever closing remark, but no. I appreciate the opportunity to sort of put a bit of a case forward.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dave.
All right, thank you.
My thanks once again, Dave, for taking the time to speak with us. Make sure to check out the show notes at originalthinkers.com.au, where you'll find further information and links to everything we've talked about on today's episode. Thanks also to the sponsors of this episode, Original Tasmanian Timber. Make sure you visit tasmaniantimber.com.au, the ultimate resource for architects, designers, and anyone interested in local, sustainable, and beautiful timbers. And finally, thank you for joining me. Join me next time when I speak with Justin Bailey, Forest Steward, Forest Practices Officer, and owner of Bayleaf, a forest management consultancy. Justin will be representing the private timber growers in the supply chain.
This is particularly relevant to the architectural space because the architect will be in a position to say, not only are we using these materials for these particular inputs, these materials have come from these particular areas within this farm, this farmer took them down for these reasons, and there's some sort of market differentiation which can happen. There's provenance.